Hi, I'm Susan Lewis. I sat down with Ben Yagoda, author of The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley, and The Rebirth of the Great American Song. He said he was intrigued by what led to the end of the Great American Songbook.
The conventional wisdom is that rock and roll killed it, and there's some truth to that, but rock and roll didn't really come around till 1956 or so with Elvis and Little Richard and so forth. And as I read some historical books about this music, it was clear that as early as the late 40s and early 50s, people were saying this was over. So I guess it struck me as a kind of detective story to try to find out what or who killed the Great American Songbook.
I'd like to back up for 1 second. The Great American Songbook, as many people know, but not everybody, is not actually a songbook. It's a genre of standards.
Right.
How would you define a standard?
Well, a standard, that's a long-standing term in popular music, and what it basically has always meant is a song that is capable of being played and interpreted repeatedly again and again through the years by different performers, different artists, in a creative way. So a standard is a song basically that stood the test of time. Great American Songbook is a little bit of a narrower commodity. That phrase only came about, I believe the first time it was used was as the title of a Carmen McRae album in the 70s, and it really caught on since then. And as you say, there's no book that's called The Great American Songbook that you can buy, and officially these songs are in it. So it's a kind of the definition of what songs are in it varies according to who's doing the counting. But essentially, it's a body of a few hundred songs, 300-400 songs, most of them written between the 1920s and the 1950s by composers such as George Gershwin, Richard Rodgers, Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, Cole Porter, etc., and the slightly lesser followers. And again, songs that have stood the test of time. A key to me, as I've tried to grapple with what exactly it is the component of jazz, the relation to jazz. This music started coming about in the 20s, just as jazz was coming into prominence, and most of those composers really deeply understood jazz. And by the same token, once they wrote a song, like Richard Rodgers' Where or When, to just pick one example, a great jazz musician could do new things with it, reinterpret it, improvise, you know, whether it's an Art Tatum or a Lester Young or Billie Holiday. So there was a great back and forth between these songs and the good jazz musicians of the day.
So that's why you say that jazz rhythms and harmonies were basically at the foundation of the Great American Songbook?
I would say so, without a doubt. I mean, Gershwin is the great example, and Harold Arlen really studied jazz and black music in general. They would go up to Harlem and just see what they could find out. And of course, Gershwin eventually wrote Porgy and Bess. Some of the others, it wasn't so conscious, but it was in the air, those sounds at the time, and they couldn't help but learn from it. And by the same token, jazz is related to what ended or killed the Great American Songbook. In that post-World War II period, jazz got separated from popular music. It went on its own merry way with bebop and progressive jazz and things like that, which are great and you hear on WRTI all the time. But that music is not so much connected with songs. It's more about improvisation and creativity and artistry of various kinds. So that, to me, is part of the key of what ended that period.
That's interesting, because you also talk about how after World War II, there were a lot of different factors that affected the music business, a lot of different musical trends. And one of them was that jazz started going off into bebop. But at the same time, you also talk about people who kept standards alive. Jazz musicians like John Coltrane with My Favorite Things and Billie Holiday and other artists. So while jazz may have played a part in the demise, there were also people who were keeping these songs in the public consciousness.
Yeah, no question. And that phenomenon, it seemed to me, really kicked in the mid to late 50s when, ironically, that was around the time that the songwriting tradition was really coming to an end. But not only jazz musicians, but great vocalists like Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra and Mel Torme and Sarah Vaughan, right around that time, as well as jazz musicians like some of the people you've mentioned, Oscar Peterson and so forth, really seemed to realize that, hey, this is a canon of almost like classical music, the way classical music is interpreted and reinterpreted by different performers, we can do the same thing.
It's interesting when you talk about this environment in the 20s that produced all of these songwriters and songs, and you say at one point that all of these amazing songwriters and lyricists were born in a 17-year period, and they all knew each other, or they knew of each other. I think you compared it to the Renaissance. I was also thinking of early 20th century Paris, when there were a lot of fine artists and musicians all congregating and getting energy from one another.
Yeah, no question. It was one of those periods. And not only were they born within a short time span, but the majority of them were from New York. The big majority were Jewish, and the overwhelming majority were male. So it was a kind of homogeneous group of people. The good thing was that they inspired each other. They competed with each other. They inspired a new generation and really raised the bar of creativity the way it must have happened in some of those places that you're talking about. The bad thing about it was that it was kind of homogeneous. And through their trade organization, ASCAP, kind of deliberately or inadvertently or whatever it was, kept out other voices. I mean, including some of the African-American jazz and blues people that had inspired them couldn't get into ASCAP, couldn't get their own songs recorded and played on the radio, as well as country, what was called then hillbilly music, later called country and western. These folks could not get into ASCAP, and their music, like a Hank Williams or a Gene Autry, until this period of the late 40s, early 50s, was kept off the airwaves. So the period of demise of that Great American Songbook, that was too bad, but there was a good side to it, that new sounds that were refreshing and invigorating, and in fact led to rock and roll in many ways, started to be heard for the first time.
When you say the rebirth of the Great American Song.
Well, the subtitle is The Rebirth of the Great American Song, and there's really two rebirths. One is the one we talked about earlier, in that period starting in the mid-50s and continuing on today, the recognition that there actually is a Great American Songbook that's a canon of great material. So Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, Sarah Vaughan, Mel Torme, and so on up to the present, including, you know, Rod Stewart and Linda Ronstadt and whatever rocker you might think, keeping that as a sort of national treasure. You know, the second rebirth that I talk about is that starting in the very, very early 1960s, people like Burt Bacharach and Carole King, Willie Nelson, started writing really good songs, coming out of the rock tradition, folk, blues, as opposed to jazz. So it's different songs, generally not as complex or sophisticated, but in many cases, really good and have lasted as well, but a different type of song.
If the Great American Songbook is actually a genre and not necessarily a definite collection of songs, then are you saying that this genre has been reborn?
Well, no. You know, I started a website called thenewamericansongbook.net. And there I put forth nominations and welcome readers' nominations of songs post-1960 that are great and worthwhile and lasting and worthy of inclusion. I feel it's a different genre. So the Great American Songbook is in good hands with jazz musicians and singers and so forth, great cabaret singers. But there's also some great newer songs, and that's continuing to be done as well. I mean, writers like Paul Simon and Stephen Merritt, Joni Mitchell, continuing on with great songs today.
Okay. Now, why did you call it the B-side? Isn't the B-side normally the side that doesn't go anywhere?
Well, it's the flip side of a song, the one that's not expected to go anywhere, although some B-sides have done better than the so-called A-side. It's kind of a metaphorical title. It's not about B-sides, but the idea is that the history that I'm giving is kind of the little-known history, that the common conception is that rock and roll killed the Great American Songbook. And what I'm saying is, well, wait a second, there's a hidden history that's a little more complicated and maybe a little bit more interesting than that. So it's kind of like the B-side of history.
And is this book, would you say, optimistic?
Yes, because I'm an optimist. There is this body of incredible, great songs that is around for us to listen to and enjoy. So, yes, it ended, but things can't go on forever. I mean, the Renaissance great Italian Florentine paintings ended in about 1500. So are we sad about that? I'm not, because what was done is still there for us to look at and enjoy.
Great. Thanks, Ben Yagoda, for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.